This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The moment you've all been waiting for is here. That's right. Cephalopod Week is back. Today marks the start of our celebration of cephalopods. You know what they are? They are? That's right. Octopuses, not octopi, octopuses, squids, cuttlefish, and more. And to kick off Cephalopod Week, a new video about how an octopus might sense and view the world. What does the world look and feel like for an octopus? So for the rest of the hour, celebrating the octopus, its genes, its body, its mind. And if you've got a question or eight about the octopus, give us a call. Let me introduce my guest. Carrie Albertan is a graduate student in biology, University of Chicago. Worked on the first team to sequence the genome of an octopus. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. Thank you.
Frank Grasso is an associate professor of psychology at Brooklyn College right here in New York. He studies octopuses in the biomimic and cognitive robotics lab at Brooklyn College. He's here with us in our studios.
Hello, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. And of course, he's the main character in a new cephalopod video produced by our own Luke Roskin. And Luke is here in our studios as well. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Good to have you all back. Carrie, you were part of a team that mapped out the genome of one species of octopus last year. And what did you discover?
Oh, we found so many things that were really pretty unexpected for us. I mean, one of the biggest things that we were surprised by was how completely normal at the level of gene families the octopus genome looked. So when we sequenced it, we kind of went through and looked for different families of genes. And when we did that, we found that they have kind of the normal number and kinds of genes that are found in other animals like snails and worms. And this was kind of particularly surprising to us because cephalopods have very big genomes. So the genome of the species of octopus that we sequenced, Octopus bimaculoides, is about 2.7 billion base pairs. Uh-huh. And that's about 90% of the size of the human genome, which is about 3.2 billion. And this is many times bigger than the genomes of other animals. So we'd thought that they'd actually gotten this big by making multiple copies of their genomes. And this may sound like kind of a crazy idea, but this is actually what happened along the lineage of animals that led to vertebrates like mammals and fish. So mammals and fish actually have multiple copies of their genome, multiple copies of each gene. So when we were looking through the octopus genome, we didn't actually see that signal, and we were really surprised by that.
So do you have an idea what all those extra all those genes are used for?
Some of them, yes. Some of them, no. So we found about 10% of the genes didn't have a match to anything in any other animals. So that's really exciting. And we know that there's a family of these genes that are called the reflectins, and they're involved in the coloration, the structural iridescence that's formed in the adaptive camouflage response that these animals have. And, you know, so this is just one gene family out of a whole bunch. Wow. So there's a lot to discover here. We also found that there were a couple of gene families that were massively expanded. So most of the gene families just had a single copy of the gene of the different members. But there was this one family that's called the protocadherins. And this is a group of genes that are involved in cell adhesion. And they've been studied in vertebrates where they play a role in setting up neuronal wiring. But they hadn't been really described in other animals. And so we thought we were pretty special. We've got about 60 of them. So we were really shocked when we looked in the octopus genome and found 168 of them. And near as we can tell, the last common ancestor of vertebrates and octopus only had one copy of them.
Wow.
Of this gene. So, you know, they had to expand them independently. I think, you know, things like that are really exciting.
Frank, I know you're excited. You've been nodding your head up and down as she spoke. You're excited.
I think this is really a wonderful set of studies, and it's opening the doors to the floodgates of a whole bunch of knowledge. We've needed this for a very, very long time. For a long time, people didn't understand where octopuses came from and evolutionarily. In terms of their genetic composition and so forth, so many fundamental questions about these really bizarre and unusual animals in terms of their bodies and their brains will begin to be put on a solid footing with this research.
What I found interesting about learning about octopuses is that part of their brains are in their arms?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
So we talk about the central nervous system of these animals because there's a distinction between the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. And to call it the brain is technically incorrect, but in terms of the computational function of the nerve cords that run through the arms, they really are acting like eight brains that are wired together to the central brain, which is the one that we would consider the cerebral ganglia.
And don't call them tentacles.
Absolutely not. They are arms. Tentacles are a really special kind of thing, which has an interesting kind of neural innovation and functional architecture that are really useful and commonly spread across the cephalopods, but octopuses didn't get one of them.
All right, let's go to the phones to Zoe in Elk Grove, California. Hi, Zoe.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My name's Zoe, and I want to know, where are octopuses' eyes?
Where are their eyes?
Well, their eyes are naturally enough on the top of their heads, right? So if you look at an octopus, you'll see a head, and the eyes have this really interesting feature, Zoe, that I think you'd like. They can actually put up little, like, whiskers by reshaping their skin to kind of reflect whether or not they're aroused. Maybe we could think about it, whether or not they're angry. Kind of like when a person raises their eyebrows.
Oh, that's good analogy. Is that okay, Zoe? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Luke, you've been to Frank's lab. Must be a fun place to be in.
Well, you know, I got to be honest. It looks just like a bunch of fish tanks stacked on top of one another. But if you do look closely, you'll notice that there are special kind of rims around the edges of the tanks to make sure that the octopuses can't escape. And then, of course, the filtration systems are specially set up so that an octopus can't squeeze on through and up through and escape that way. And I also got to meet some of the octopuses there. I believe every successive year the octopuses' names go by a certain alphabetical order. So previous years was the M year. There was Mufasa and Magneto, who are in senescence, which is a stage of life that octopuses enter when they get a little older and they just want to kind of sit around and watch crab shells. And then the more new ones, Noob and Nugget, who are a lot more active and checking out their environment. Really, really always curious, and they really come up right to the front of the glass and they check you out and they want to see what you're up to.
Yeah. Carrie, have cephalopods evolved different ways to do some of the same things that vertebrates do? We're talking about those big eyes, right, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. The eyes are a classic example of convergent evolution between vertebrates and cephalopods. They're set up in terms of gross anatomy, they look very similar. It's a camera-type eye with a lens. It creates a proper image. These are some questions that we're really interested in exploring. Are there different ways of making the same structure? Or are they based in more or less the same, like the same gene families setting things up?
Mm-hmm. How close evolutionary or in history have octopuses, are the octopuses to squids? I heard they're like millions of years apart. Is that true?
Yeah. So I think current methods put them at about 270 million years diverged, right? And so to kind of put that in perspective, that's before the first dinosaur was walking the Earth. These are really old families.
Yeah. Wow. I'm stunned.
So the
right?
Yeah.
So they've had a lot of time to figure out how to do new and different things. And so even though we kind of group them together, and they are definitely a group, they've had a lot of time to come up with new solutions to different problems.
Looking at the fossil record, where there are fossil records for these things, these animals diverged from our stem somewhere around 505 to 545 million years ago. And in between the time that she just mentioned and 505 million years ago, there was this plethora of species all competing and fighting their way out for a place in the sea. And probably the evolution of the brains from the primordial sort of molluscan form emerged as a result of all of these forms, the benthonites and all kinds of unusual forms that went extinct in between the ancestral cephalopod and the modern coleoid cephalopods that are the squids, the cuttlefishes, and the octopuses.
Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer, Wisconsin. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Ira. And when I heard this was a cephalopod, what is cephalopod, week?
Yes.
Or month?
Week. Whole week. A whole week.
Not
we,
a month
we should
yet.
Have a month,
not a
actually.
Month yet. We're, you know, working
we're working
our way.
Up to it, yeah.
I said to myself, I could use another arm right now. And so because I recently broke my ankle. But anyway, and about 35 years ago, I was living on a sailboat, and we were in St. Bart's. And my friend got a spear gun out and went down to get a lobster. And while we were down there, it was just underneath his boat, like maybe 40 feet. And he looked at me. There was a baby octopus, and we looked at each other, no words spoken, of course. And he put his spear gun out, and the little baby octopus wrapped one of his, is it a tentacle?
It's an arm.
An arm?
Arm.
he wrapped it around the spear gun, and it was just a moment of joy. That was just, I bet you, I haven't spoken to him since then, and I just know that we would both remember this, like, with vivid imagery. It was amazing. I just think they're very wonderful animals.
Yeah, thanks for your call. They have a reputation for being really smart.
Right.
Are they as smart as, I mean, they're clever, right?
So let me pick up on both the thing that Luke mentioned and that caller just mentioned. There is this sense that you get when you face an octopus in a tank or in the water that it is sentient and it's participating with you. And to say that they're smart is a difficult thing. To say that they're intelligent, you need a careful definition of intelligence. But their behavior is so complex. And if we're not overly anthropomorphizing, it's true, they orient to you, they seem to attend to you visually, and they make reactions. They actually do. And there's a literature about the fact that individual cephalopods will keep track of the particular people that they have interacted with in laboratories. And when they get mad at, there are these apocryphal stories where they get mad at individuals and will squirt at them across the room as they approach because they recognize the individuals. So it's a humorous thing, and it may or may not be scientific, but I've seen these kinds of things, and it certainly goes along with the impression that the animals give when you see them.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Luke, tell us about your video. How fun was it shooting? Difficult? Did you have to go mano a mano with the octopus?
No, outthink it? I've had experiences at the New York Aquarium getting hickeys from octopus suckers, but not this time. Didn't get that intimate with them. It was interesting though, talking with Dr. Grasso about this notion of self-awareness. I've always been curious with different animals that have self-awareness, like chimps. They see themselves in a mirror. Well, do octopuses have that? But in talking with Dr. Grasso, he revealed, and we talk about in the video, that octopuses have their own kind of form of self-awareness. It may not reach their upper brain, but they have their own form of self-awareness via their suckers. They can taste themselves. So it'd be like if you licked your arm and you were like, yep, that's me. That's definitely me.
Yeah.
Or if I blindfolded you, put you in a room with other people and told you to lick other people's arms, and then somehow were able to replicate the taste of your arm, and then you licked it and went, oh, that's me. Yeah. It's a little bizarre, but octopuses can do that, which is absolutely fascinating.
And this is work that I did in collaboration with colleagues at the Hebrew University. And it makes great sense for an octopus to be able to have a chemical recognition mechanism.
Yeah.
If you have eight arms that are flopping around and have a reflex to attach to whatever they hit, no questions asked, you don't want the octopus tying itself into knots.
That's
and
interesting.
This self-recognition mechanism, or at least self-detection mechanisms, is kind of a self-defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. See if we get a quick question in from Chuck in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead.
Hi, Ira. I love your show. Thank you for having
me
on Friday. Hey, what's the difference between an octopus and a squid?
Okay. Gary, do you want to talk about that?
So octopuses and their relatives have eight arms. Squid and their relatives, like cuttlefish, have eight arms plus two tentacles. So that's where the tentacles come in. And they also have inside a kind of an internal shell. In squids, it's a pen. It helps hold their body, their mantle, which is where they keep all of their stomach and their digestive organs and their hearts. It holds it out. So when they're swimming, it stays in the right orientation.
That's there you have it. Luke, in addition to this video with Frank, there's another cephalopod video.
Oh, yeah. Next week.
In the works.
Yeah. Next week, we're going to be putting up a video about deep sea squid and how they use ink. I mean, think about that. Why would a squid that lives in total darkness need ink? I mean, we think about ink as being, you know, something to escape from a predator. Well, there's other reasons, you know.
You're not going to get a hint?
Perhaps you're going to attract a mate. Perhaps you're going to repel a predator. Or perhaps, perhaps you're just going to obfuscate yourself before you strike at prey. Perhaps it's a predation technique. So that's a video that's coming next week. And then there are other videos from our partners like the American Museum of Natural History and Monterey Bay Aquarium that are coming out that are all about this kind of celebration of cephalopods. We have articles that are up on sciencefriday.com about how we have a profile of Roger Hanlon, who's been studying the camouflage of cephalopods.
Where's the octopus video? One of the most famous ones we have.
And then we have a profile of the flamboyant cuttlefish, which is basically the equivalent of a squid at a rave. It's really, really cool-looking animal. We have a couple of education activities like squid prints, where you can make prints using a squid and you can look at their anatomy. We're going to have a live Facebook with squids for kids, where we're going to look at it's going to be an anatomy demonstration of squids. We're going to have a cephalopod movie night.
A movie night,
where? Yes. In Brooklyn, if you live in New York City, go to sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek and check that out. And of course, we want you to join in. We want you to share your cephalies, your photos of you with your cephalopod tattoos, your art. We want you to go to cephalopodweek.tumblr.com to check out all the news that's going on with Cephalopod Week.
It's a giant cephalo party.
Yes.
So it is.
It's a cephalabration.
Cephalabration. Okay.
We squid you not.
And they will go on all week. Albert Dinn is graduate student of biology at the University of Chicago. Frank Grasso, associate professor of psychology at Brooklyn College, and our own Luke Ruskin. And you can see his videos and that stuff up on our website at sciencefriday.com and enjoy all our Cephalopod Week activities and materials at sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek. Thank you all. It's going to be a great week.